when David and Ann asked me if I would be so kind as to write a sermon or deliver a sermon about Earth Day, I had a few that I'd already written in a barrel, and maybe I should have done one of those because I've spent the whole week in Texas. But then I came back and I worked all day yesterday. Trying to help people recognize the arc from transcendentalism to modern ecological awareness. You know, the transcendentalists were kind of the first reform movement in American history. This is the 1830s and 40s. And it had a literary, a political, and a religious dimension. The literary was Whitman, Thoreau, Herman Melville, and Emerson primarily, and Thoreau. And the religious dimension was William Ellery Channing and how it translated into church life in New England at that time, which Emerson had called the Unitarians, what, God's frozen people, because they were so left-lobed, you know, and kind of rigid, and they weren't Puritans anymore, but it'd be hard to tell that looking at them. And then there's a political dimension, which, you know, I think most of us, some had a course or a couple of days about transcendentalism in high school, and I didn't get it at all, but the political dimension is essentially the section in your textbook about Jacksonian democracy, the expansion of the franchise. Jackson was a terrible racist, but he did expand the franchise beyond propertied white men to people with very modest means, and from there, further development in years and decades to come. Now, of all the transcendentalists, the one who I think most focuses the transcendentalist ethos was Henry David Thoreau. He lived in Concord, Massachusetts his whole life. He was born in 1817. He died in the midst of the Civil War, so he's only 40-something. And he wrote Walden. He wrote On Civil Disobedience. Most of us read in high school, too. And the other book was A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers, describing, actually it was 2 weeks that he and his brother rode from Concord to Newburyport. Anyway, long way. And he describes himself this way. I'm a schoolmaster, a private tutor, a surveyor, a gardener, a farmer, a painter, I mean a house painter, a carpenter, a mason, a day laborer, a pencil maker, a glass paper maker, a writer, and sometimes a poet. Well, beyond all that, he was a surveyor. He was employed by the city of Concord to boundary disputes and so on. And so that's how he started walking everywhere. And he learned how to walk in people's property and not be seen, not because he was sneaking around, but just because it made it simpler to carry out these chores. He walked from Mount Catawba in Maine to Cape Cod to New Haven. And Henry David Thoreau was among the first American writers to consider the culture of Native Americans as worthy of study and respect. And he had a long way to go, but he was miles ahead of his contemporaries in that regard. So going from Thoreau to this movement that we call the conservation movement, the environmental movement, and now the ecological movement. I would say the next person was John Burroughs, who was born in the 1830s through 1921. He's less well known today, but he was a very prominent naturalist. He lived in the Hudson Valley, and he was kind of the founder of the American conservation movement. A contemporary of his, also born in the 1830s and who lived until World War I, it's about the same for Burroughs, was far better known, John Muir. and a very successful advocate of preservation of wilderness in America, often referred to as the founder of our national parks. We wrote a lot. It's all worth reading, but I'm going to quote one sentence. Everybody needs beauty, places to play in and pray in, where nature may heal and cheer and give strength to the body and soul alike. Now, John Muir had enormous influence across the land. He started essentially what became the Sierra Club. And that influence included, beginning with the turn of the century to the 20th century, the President of the United States, Theodore Roosevelt, the greatest of the conservationists. I remember going to Mount Rushmore and reading a quote of the sculptor who described why he chose those four faces. Washington was the founder. Jefferson was the expander with the purchase of Louisiana and the movement to cover the whole continent. Lincoln, the preserver, who saw our nation and its people through the trial of the Civil War. And Theodore Roosevelt, the conserver, who recognized that the early years of the 20th century the need to preserve our natural wilderness for future generations. So those are I'm labeling these people, Muir from Thoreau, Burroughs, Muir to Teddy Roosevelt, as the conservationists. But things began to change in the early years and mid years of the 20th century, and it wasn't enough just to conserve. There had to be a deeper awareness of what nature afforded us, its gifts and its peril. Rachel Carson was born in 1907, and she lived through 1964. And her book, Silent Spring, and other writings are credited with advancing the environmental movement. Now, my eighth grade teacher, Mr. Olson, public Roxborough Junior High, I was in the AP science class, Lord knows why, and he bought copies of Silent Spring for the class, for everybody. Little, you know, it was, I don't know, 95 cents in 1963. He bought that book for all of us and made us read it, and that kind of woke me up. Although Silent Spring met with fierce opposition by chemical companies, it spurred a reversal in national pesticide policy, the banning of DDT, and the beginnings of a grassroots environmental movement leading to the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency under President Kennedy. The EPA, of course, is currently under desperate siege by the Trump administration. In 1975, building on Rachel Carson's work and others, I should say Rachel Carson grew up in a conservative Presbyterian family in Pittsburgh, but in all her years working for the for the United States government, and she lived in Washington. She spent the summers in Maine with her partner, a woman that they were, I can't remember her name right now, but anyway, she attended All Souls Unitarian Church. And when she died, her partner said, they both attended, she said, we'll do it at All Souls. No, her Orthodox conservative Presbyterian family said, and they had the service at the National Cathedral, and not even in the sanctuary, in a little off ante room, just for somebody of her stature, it just blows my mind. Anyway, we can claim her as a Unitarian. In 1975, geochemist Wallace Broker, published an article in the journal Science that included the phrase global warming. The first time the phrase was used in a scientific paper. In it, Broker argued that humans were changing the climate by emitting CO2. It just was not evident yet, but it soon would be. It wasn't evident because he had also recognized a 40-year cycle of cold periods, hot periods, and they were toward the end of a cold period, but he predicted that that would soon change, and right on cue, the very next year, temperatures started rising and have continued ever since on the very trajectory Broecker lined out or predicted. Now, our seventh Unitarian Universalist principle, respect for the interdependent web of existence of which we are a part, would have us go beyond environmentalism into an ecological consciousness in which nature is not something that surrounds us, but something we're in dynamic interrelationship with. Internally and externally, there's a river flowing through my soul and it's connected, it's identical in certain ways with the rivers of the planet. The Gaia hypothesis, formulated by chemist James Lovelock and co-developed by microbiologist Lynn Margulis in the 1970s, proposes that living organisms interact with their inorganic surroundings on Earth to form a synergistic and self-regulating complex system that helps to maintain and perpetuate the conditions for life on our planet. Lovelock named the theory after Gaia, the primordial goddess who personified the Earth in Greek mythology. Geography comes out of that same root. And so they had the idea that it wasn't, evolution was not about the survival of individual species who then dominated others. It was co-evolution. All the animals, all the plants, everything is co-evolving in a dynamical pattern. And this morning's Henry David Thoreau readings about turtles kind of adumbrates or foreshadows this idea of Gaia. Also related to the Gaia hypothesis are notions about how the biosphere and the evolution of organisms affect the stability of global temperature, salinity of seawater, atmospheric oxygen levels, and the maintenance of a hydrosphere of liquid water and other environmental variables that affect our planet's very habitability. In the years since Lovelock and Margulis published Gaia, other scientific work has focused on what coevolution, this mutual evolvement, means regarding humanity's self-ascribed position as crown of creation, with dominion over all other life. Consider the work of American physician, psychoanalyst, and philosopher John Lilly, a pioneer scientific researcher in attempting to communicate with dolphins. People forget his dolphin work because he invented the sensory deprivation tank, and people like that more than dolphins, I guess. But he did a decade's worth of work trying to communicate and having some success. Or consider the work of Diane Fossey, an American primatologist and conservationist known for her extensive study of mountain gorilla groups from 1966 and 1985, when she was murdered by commercial and military interests that were threatened by her work. Jane Goodall has carried on Dr. Fossey's work, and Gorillas in the Mist is all about their efforts, the movie. The idea that species other than Homo sapiens have consciousness has been expanded by the work of author, journalist, and activist Michael Pollan. Plants are intelligent, Pollan writes, not necessarily the way we think of intelligence, but in a way appropriate to themselves. We human beings can do many things, things plants cannot do. Yet they can do things we cannot, like climbing out of a steel cage or eating sunlight. If you define intelligence as the ability to solve the novel problems reality throws at the living, plants surely have intelligence. They also possess agency and an awareness of their environment, and a kind of subjectivity, set of interests they pursue, and so a point of view. Doctors Lilly, Fossey, Goodall, and Poland's research indicates that the blessing of consciousness is distributed more broadly than among only ourselves, breaking the human monopoly on subjectivity that we moderns take as a given. To most human beings, most moderns, people are the world's only subjects, with the rest of the world made up of objects. And the more, we all know people who are so egocentric that they even treat other people as objects. And you think about this, consider virtually all Republicans, and plenty of Democrats too, believe that industrial growth and commercialism are good things, are very good. Their worldview sees the planet as essentially a machine and human society as a corporation or syndicate drawn together to benefit its members by optimal use of extractable resources. If, as such folks sincerely do believe, my dad among them, my late dad, our planet, if they all think that our planet is like a machine, then its parts can be replaced and are only externally related. Moreover, reality is not alive. We can use it and discard it when it's worn out. But the conservationist, environmentalist, ecologists I've been holding up this morning see the planet more like an organism or community that survives and prospers through the interrelationship and interdependence of its many parts, both human and non-human. Their ecological worldview, like that of their predecessors, Henry David Thoreau, John Muir, Rachel Carson, and the rest, and a growing consensus of scientists everywhere, they see the world more like an organism, a body, the parts of which cannot be replaced, though some of them can sometimes be renewed through growth. Since the parts are internally related and alive, we are not only responsible for the world's well-being, we can also sympathize with those parts that are suffering or in pain. In simple, non-theological, non-scientific language, the ecological worldview claims that as planetary housemates, we must abide by three main rules. Take only your share, clean up after yourselves, and keep the house in good repair for future occupants. And these, I'm still proud that I'm an Eagle Scout and I worked at a scout camp. And these are the rules we learned about being a good scout, Clean up after yourself, just take enough for yourself, and keep, and that in Native American bromide, think of the impact of your decisions to the seventh generation. In the spring of 1970, former Vice President Al Gore and I both took a new course offering at our respective colleges that changed both of our lives. Ecology is a new word, almost. It was the birth of Earth Day. So this Earth Day is the 49th. In his award-winning movie, An Inconvenient Truth, former President Gore, Vice President Gore, discusses the college class he took and how it became the impetus for all his efforts to awaken people to the growing danger of climate change. There is an overwhelming consensus among the world's weather experts that we can expect a 2.5 degrees Celsius warming of worldwide temperatures by the year 2050 and perhaps up to 6 degrees by the end of the century. Now, you've got to put this in context because it's very significant. The Earth's temperature during the last ice age was 5 to 6 degrees cooler than it is now. Raising it that much would be devastating from a human point of view. Desertification of chief grain-producing lands, scarcity of fresh water, loss of trees, flooding of coastal areas and islands, the spread of tropical diseases, violent weather events, shortages of food, and so on. And we're seeing some of these trends emerge. Global warming will change life as we know it. And it's already begun to do so. Through our hyperactive consumer lifestyle, we've triggered fearful, though still largely unknown, consequences for the weather system in which we and everything else on the planet depends and exists for us, of us. Meteorologists do not know how serious this will actually turn out to be, but some are increasingly afraid of the prospect of a runaway greenhouse effect, the crossing of the line into irreversible temperature increases. Yikes. Such a specter led the late Kurt Vonnegut, a lifelong Unitarian Universalist, to close his final book with the lines, "When the last living thing has died on account of us, how poetical it would be if Earth could say in a voice floating up, perhaps from the floor of the Grand Canyon, 'It is done. People did not like it here.' Is that our fate? I surely hope not, and am resolved to find ways to lessen my carbon footprint on the Earth and simplify my life." The heart of Henry David Thoreau's philosophy. May we all learn to do likewise. In contrast to Vonnegut's dyspeptic vision, the last entry of Diane Fossey's diary, written the night she was murdered by commercial and political and military interests threatened by her research, was as follows. Her last words, really. "When you realize the value of all life, you dwell less on what is past and concentrate more on the preservation of the future. So may it be for all of us. Amen."